Hello, listeners. You're once again very welcome to this, the podcast of the Irish Wood and Interiors Network. Don't forget to check us out on the web at www.iwin.ie. Today, I'm absolutely delighted to be talking to Owen and Mark McGinn from McGinn Machinery. Owen and Mark from McGinn Machinery, delighted to be talking to you today. Thank you very much for joining me. Much appreciated.
Nice to meet you, Owen. Yeah.
We might start off, McGinn Machinery, it's been around for quite a long time. Maybe you might give us, you know, a bit of background, a short history of how it kind of began.
Yeah, well, basically it began, not so much McGinn Machinery, but our involvement in the woodworking industry began back in the 1970s when my father, he was supplying goods to the garages, hand tools, hammers, and various things for crash cars, putting them back to rights. And he would call into all these garages around the country and stay in the various towns. Indeed, he'd even sleep in his car when he'd be going from one place to the other. And one day he went into Roadmaster Caravans in Johnstown. And Miles McCabe, who was the guy who had set it up, quite an entrepreneur, turned around to him and said, "McGinn, you speak fluent German, don't you?" He says, he showed him two catalogs and he says, "There's two machines I'm looking for, two woodworking machines." He says, "You'll get them in Germany secondhand, and here's the price I'm prepared to pay for them." So that was fine. My father took the ball on the hop and went off to Germany with £15 in his pocket, he told me, and met Walter Berman, who was the major secondhand machinery supplier in Germany, did a deal, identified the machines and imported them for Roadmaster. So that was really his start in the industry, and that's how woodwork machines became the thing. So he built the business from there, importing secondhand machines, new machines, storing them on the docks, working out of a small office in Harcourt Street, and gradually built the business. He was a very entrepreneurial guy, not great on finances, but very entrepreneurial. So he built it up, kept adding more staff, bigger stocks. All he just loved doing was selling. That was the fun he got in life. And then as he was building, he would come across things like tooling. Oh, we're supplying loads of machines, and where are the people getting their tooling? So he would set up a company with some guy who was in that business. And once it got up and running, he never looked at their books. All he was interested in was, "There's all our business. How's it going? And you're selling much?" And all he wanted to hear was a good news story. So that's how it built up and built up until it was quite a large business, employing more than 40 people with small little branches in Belfast, Cork, and even in Leicester in England.
I actually worked in the Cork division for 2 years when I was a young fella. And all that other stuff was way before my time, so I wouldn't remember any of that.
Well, I heard you didn't work at all.
There was a bit of that involved as well.
Anyway, yeah. So that was it was quite a large business and so on like that. But as I said, indicated, finance wasn't his strong point. So when the recession came in the late 79, early 80s, the whole thing collapsed. And basically it was
starting.
It was a question of we're going to have to start again.
But just on that, the first thing that strikes me is, in terms of your father being entrepreneurial and whatever, he kind of almost changed his industry and his career, first of all, when he was setting up. And
oh yeah, sure. He was a farmer before anything, right? He was a shopkeeper first, then he was a farmer, and three of my siblings were born in Belfast, right, when we lived in Northern Ireland. And then my mother didn't like living in the country, so her being from Desmond Street in Dublin, so she brought us back and he had to follow. So that's the sort of history.
That's the sort of guy he was.
Yeah, did all sorts of stuff. So yes, it wasn't automatically into the business. It morphed into the business, yeah.
But then the business kind of hit, kind of, as you're saying, a wall in the recession then in sort of 79 and into the 80s, which anyone who was around then remembered it was all a bit bleak and glum and things weren't looking too good. But like, I mean, in terms of sort of starting again or, you know, taking stock and starting from scratch, I mean, what was that like?
Yeah, that was tough because that, as you say, that 1981 recession was really a hard recession. And what we were left looking at each other and saying, well, what do we do? So it was a question of starting again. So Mark and myself started the new business, McGinn Machinery, with the father helping and to some extent in the background with one of my sisters, Maureen, and later on we employed Katrina and Sheila. So
our other sisters.
A family business.
Yeah.
So that was, we were working out in my father's front room, and then we rented a premises in John F. Kennedy. And
that's the one we're in now.
That's the one that right, yeah.
Yeah.
And basically built it up slowly from there. I think you remember the first customer who came into you.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah. There was this lad, we were only reminiscing there before this one, a fellow called Billy Stowe. And I was sitting in my office with all my filing cabinet and my catalogs and all that. And he came in with his redundancy money out of a job that he'd been made redundant from. And he wanted to buy a universal woodworker to set up and feed his family. Well, I tell you, I was the most nervous young fella you ever met in his in your life, because I was taking all his money and guaranteeing him that he was going to feed his family. But he remained a good, loyal customer for about 20 years afterwards. And I used to go down and visit him in his house and stuff like that. But he always stuck in my mind as that's the man that sort of broke the ice for me.
Yeah, we would have, at the time, because of the way the lack of money, we would have spent a lot of time selling secondhand machines. We'd buy in secondhand machines that were sort of surplus to requirements or were places that had closed their business, and we clean them up and sell them off again. So there was a lot of that. Some new machines as well. I remember in particular one, we were only in business about 6 months when I got a phone call from Donald Ring, the owner of Munster Joinery. And he asked me to get him the price of a spindle motor, tenoner and a cramp, and to get the best price and come down and see him. So I went down and I was in Bally Desmond and we were sitting around. He says, right now, Owen, is this the best price you can get? And I said, yeah, it is. He says, right. He says, we'll take 20 spindle molders, five automatic tenoners and five cramps. I swear, it was so crazy because we'd only ever sold one of any of these machines before. And I'm sure he was laughing at me out of the side of it, you know, quietly, because I was trying to act cool, as if this was normal. But really, it was a great start for me at that stage. It gave great confidence to continue on. And then we built it up from there, selling secondhand machines and some new machines.
Yeah, at one stage, we were selling between 500 and 600 machines a year. Right. So it was a huge quantity of standard machines going out. Like you would in 1 year, you might sell over 100 panel saws. You might sell 50, 60 edge banders. You might sell spindle motors, lots and lots, extractors, 100 of them, 200 of them. So it was.
Yeah, because there were a lot of small workshops around the country. There wasn't so much the large ones, you know. Yeah. So that was basically the start of it.
Well, just guys, while I have the two of you here, just a couple of things I want to pick up on. The first one is Mark, you're saying when you were starting out, I mean, you kind of started from scratch and you're talking about being a nervous young fella. I think anybody in business who's honest with themselves, when they start off, they kind of have a bit of lump in their throat and they're not sure if it's going to work out. And then Owen, again, when you start out in business, you have this thing, somebody comes up to you. And you know you're kind of in a way sure of yourself, but somebody comes up to you with a huge order, and you can't turn around to them and say, "Well, listen, I can't do it," because I mean you're out of business. Then you have to kind of put your money where your mouth is, and you have to say, "Yeah, absolutely, I'll take the order, you know, whatever it takes, and I'll get on with it." So the Perry is you're kind of starting from nothing with not a shilling and probably other responsibilities. I mean, you know, everybody in business I think has the same sort of background story. I mean, what's it like?
Yeah, well, all I can say is it still makes me sweat a little bit when we talk about it now, because when you go back to that, it is definitely exactly as you've described. You have confidence, but you're not convinced completely. And as you say, you're offered, either somebody comes in and says, I want to buy a machine with my redundancy, in which case it's really something where you really want to be sure that you're doing the right thing by them, you know, and you can only hope. And the same with, say,
the
guy with the big order. It was being able to finance it, being able to back it up. It's just, you really felt he was sort of putting his trust in you, and you felt it, and you just could not let that go. You know, you couldn't let that person down. It was going to take everything to just make sure that those particular orders went through. I mean, later on, you gain a bit of confidence. Yeah.
We had a roll of paper, which was about 10 foot long. And when you rolled it out, it showed you what letters of credit you had open with suppliers and that, and when they were going to come due. So you were always watching the overlap of one to the other so that you made sure that you had the finance, because there was no computer telling you this. It was a roll of paper spread out on a couch at home at night time going, I think we can afford to do it if we do it this way. And that was the way it was done. So, yeah, it was a lot of seat of the pants stuff.
But also because of as we said, the lack of concern about the finances in my father's business, we were super cautious in some ways, making sure we didn't get caught. We were very lucky to have learned and to have observed the mistakes and to learn from them. It really helped us in running our business and keeping it going during the crashes and things like that, because all the lessons you'd learned in 1981 paid off. Like,
exactly. You know, yeah.
That was basically it.
But sure, everything we do and the mistakes we make, it kind of adds up to experience, but it's a good thing that you can take some of your father's mistakes and not make the same ones, you
know? That was handy when you started thinking about it. Yes.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
Not everyone does that. Some people look at their father and then they go off and they make the same mistakes that he's made all over again. Their children want to do the same thing. But look, you know, you've seen a lot of changes over the years in the industry. I mean, is there anything in particular, or maybe a couple of things that kind of stand out for you?
Well, it's 40 years now. We're actually celebrating the 40th anniversary this year. So we've been in business a long time. Well, when we look back, you see, obviously, recessions, booms, crashes, and we survived them all in various ways, but some of them by the skin of our teeth. With when the crash happened, it was traumatic. But yeah, when we started, the business in general was small companies, small family companies working in a shed beside their house. Most of our customers were in that category. I mean, there was the Monaghan factories, who stand out at the time, who were Sherry Brothers and McNally and Findlay, and they were sophisticated. But the vast majority of the businesses that we were dealing with were using standard machines, some of them 50 years old, making windows, doors, kitchens, to some extent with traditional craft. I mean, business, but also with a certain...
Yeah, the guys in the workshop knew what they were doing, and they would have a lot of experience. So they could use spindle molders relatively safely. I must say, there was most workshops now, there were lads in them with fingers and stuff missing, but they were skilled people, really skilled. So that began to fade away over a period of time, especially when you got a bad recession, because these guys were so skilled, they could go off to America, Australia and get jobs there. So they sort of either emigrated or found other jobs, or that sort of, they took that sort of action to feed their families. So you ended up after, especially the last one in 2008, where the skill level had dropped dramatically. And then what happens is the machines come in And then you go for, the lads can't get workers, so they go for automation. They go for less skill needed, more the machine doing the job than the person doing the job on the machine.
Yeah. When we look back and on the over the period of time, one of the things, obviously the industry was gradually changing from this family business beside the house into a maybe somewhat less numbers of people, but yet more automated equipment or more sophisticated equipment. One of the things we were talking about here was from the very start, we started to run a trip to the exhibitions in Germany. Once a year, there was an exhibition in Germany or an exhibition in Milan in Italy. And we would run a trip. It was before Ryanair. So we'd sort of organize the flights, we'd organize the hotels, we'd organize the buses, everything would be organized. And
we ended up a travel agent once a year, didn't we?
We did.
Yeah. Very complicated when people start phoning up. I can't go on Wednesday, it's my child's communion. It was awful.
Block booked passports was one of the comments I got on the phone. But anyway, we would have had between 50 and 100 people traveling every year on these trips to the exhibition. It was quite, it became quite a big undertaking.
Yeah, actually, we chartered an airplane once.
That's right, it was all, yeah. 95 of us.
95, chartered a
737.
737 and flew to Hanover. The Irish were on their way.
So there was the manufacturers used to say there was a lot more Irish at those exhibitions than there were any other nationality for the size of the country. And I think that was a big part of the development of the industry, in that the people were prepared. Obviously, it was the our customers, the workshop owners were prepared to get on a plane, go over to Hanover. I mean, it would take a week.
Yeah, if you saw something, you had to stop and take note, because if you said, I'll come back to that, you would never find it again. It was such a big exhibition, 23 halls, I think, of machines doing every permutation of work. So that was our criteria with the customer. Lads, when you go out here now and you're walking the halls, stop and take note. And remember, they've no mobile phones to take pictures or anything like that. They actually had to write it down, right? But it worked, and they would then come back and inquire about things they had seen and stuff like that. So it educated us.
Yeah,
continuously during the year.
But even in the, say, if everybody was out and arrived in the bus, and we eventually got them on the bus, we'd arrive at the exhibition and they'd spread out. And at the end of the day, in Germany anyway, we'd all meet up in the beer hall, and there'd be 95 people sitting at the one table in the beer hall. That was a fantastic experience. I remember looking down the table and seeing it's stretching as far as the eye could see, 95 Irish people all sitting, having a beer and eating some food. But they started to swap all the information between themselves. Competitors became friends.
They'd be cagey at first, and by the end of the evening, they were telling every secret they had, but they were getting back secrets as well. So they became friends. You could see in the airport when you got back to Dublin, they were all shaking hands and wishing each other luck, and off they went. So it was an advantage to everybody. There was no disadvantage to it.
When I was talking about this, I was thinking it was a bit like a primitive version of your IWIN's peer-to-peer program. That was so. When I hear the lads talk, and I was hearing Owen Ryan and
Mark Connolly, yeah,
that's right, Mark. Yes, I couldn't think of his name, even though it was yourself. But when they talk about it, I could just say, yeah, this is an advance on that sort of swapping of information that was going on in the beer halls or in the restaurants in Italy. It was really fantastic that they were prepared to leave their business and go. When travel wasn't normal at the time, all before Ryanair, as I say, they were prepared to go over and learn. And okay, some beer was drunk, but by jeepers, there was a lot of walking of those halls and a lot of ideas picked up. Small ideas and big ideas. Yeah.
Well, look, yeah. I mean, business is basically, it's person to person, isn't it? It's making those connections and building up relationships. But just in terms of starting off from a, you know, a small family business, we've touched on some of this. You know, it's quite a bigger and more sophisticated sort of business now. In terms of scaling up, you started as a family business, you know, taking on other people. And, you know, how did you find that? And, you know, how did you, were there challenges in that?
Well, yeah, it was really, because if you went looking for technicians, back then there was very little, again, industry in Ireland that was growing these technicians that you could find. And it's still a very big challenge there. So when you want your technicians, you had to get them and train them and send them out in the market and hope that they learned and enjoyed the job, right? Staff inside, a lot of family, right? So that worked quite well. Yes. And more from there, because when you had people here, like Alan Marr has been with us for 30 odd years, and he has found some people that he knows who came to work for us. His sister-in-law worked for us, his friend's son is working for us now, and that sort of thing. So you have that sort of loyalty, because everybody is sort of affiliated with each other, you know?
Yeah, but I was thinking as well that besides our growth, the customers who we brought out to Italy to see in the different factories, because introducing the technology at the time, there was no YouTube. So when somebody came to us looking for a machine, a specialist machine or whatever, and we'd have to contact the manufacturers, ask them, could they set it up for us to bring somebody out, and that they'd see it producing something similar to what they wanted to do. And you in particular, Mark, would have taken a lot of
people. Yeah, a lot of people. And actually, sometimes you wouldn't see exactly what you were promised to see. You'd see something that sort of the manufacturer might have talked, well, at least you're seeing this. So a few excuses had to be made and a few dinners bought, but it worked out in the end, because once they saw the machines and their function and their ability, they were generally sold on the idea, you know?
Yeah, one of the things I would have felt at the time, at the early stages, was that we would never, when we bring a customer into one of these big sophisticated factories, we would never be able to compete with factories like that, the Irish woodworking industry. But we'd be looking at one particular machine in their process and sort of just to see if we could, you know, if the customer could buy that. But we compare that with now, those Italian factories, they might be big in scale, but the technology and the sophistication of the systems and the organization in the Irish factories now is equal to those top factories in Italy. It's a fantastic situation.
Credit
to the industry that it's moved to be as good as anybody. Like when it started off, I suppose, with people where they were doing the woodwork of the Air Rienta duty free in Moscow. And then the Guinness has set up the Irish pub where they sort of had a few different designs of traditional Irish pubs. And the guys started to make all the necessary woodwork and then send the stuff off in a container to Latvia or to the Far East, and then follow it out and install it themselves.
Actually, Burn Bespoke, PJ Byrne down in Atai, he was big into that. And he got paid by a Visa credit card for a pub in America. I think it was £300,000 at the time, and they had to do a special arrangement so the Visa didn't take too much commission out. He got paid by a Visa I think it was Cleveland or something like that, the pub was going into, and your man paid by credit card.
It shows this is the development of the industry to be, to my mind, world class. And now it's not a question when a chance or an order comes up for, some job that's maybe a hotel. it's not a question of can the customer do it or can they give the quality. It's whether they'll get paid the necessary money for what they know is as good as can be got. So it's a huge change in the industry, and it's a huge development from those small family beside the house sheds, you might say, to factories that are able to compete.
Yeah, and actually, the amount of work that the companies do in, say, the UK is huge. I mean, there are companies, and virtually 90% of their business is supplying into the UK market, and they're highly respected over there, whether it's a house in Kensington or a hotel fit out in London or that. They're well capable of as much as anybody to do the job and do it well, and maybe better than most. Yeah.
Well, look, while we're looking back and we're kind of reminiscing from, you know, where you've come from to where you are now, is there any particular sale of something or a machine or a plant that really stands out to you? You know, I mean, maybe it went right, maybe it went wrong, maybe somebody came and ordered something huge.
We're not going to tell you the ones that went wrong. But I'd have to have a special mention here for Tippo and Paddy Martin. And he had a devastating fire in 2015-16. And I thought, well, then Paddy's going to wrap it up at this stage, because it just, everything was destroyed. And 2 days later, he phoned me and says, where are you? Right. So I had to go down the place. The flames were still leaping out of the board and that was there. We walked through it with flames burning. It's still burning. And he said, right, how are we going to get this up and running again and up and run fast? To the extent that we flew all over Europe, we set up a secondhand machines in Nina, in a temporary accommodation. He rebuilt the factory. We ordered the machines. And I think the dust extraction alone was 20 containers sitting in the docks waiting to be called off by Fintan as the project progressed. It was a year out of my life. It's been many years out of Paddy's life. And it was such an experience. And at the end, it worked really, really well. Everybody was very happy with the results of it. So that was my experience.
Yeah, as well, because I got a chance to design. As it turned out, he was luckily well insured. And he got a chance to design his dream factory, learning, doing all the things that he would have said over the years, if only I didn't have that building this way, and if I had these machines. So he designed the plant. He specified all the equipment. It was top of the range, basically cutting edge technology at the time.
Well, he was listening to the manufacturers, and they were telling them the modern way to do things, and he went along with an awful lot of the very modern methods and that. So his factory, when it was built and running, was the most advanced in Europe, I'd say, at the time, because of the automation he put in.
Yeah, I remember in particular one machine down when I was down there we've supplied a number of them since, is the Windstore, which is a sort of a storage, automated storage area where all the boards that come into the factory all get stored, and it works throughout the night, getting the packs ready for the machines the next morning. So when the guy walks in,
it feeds one of the machines. So not only is it feeding out to feed the other machines, but it's feeding a CNC in itself as well. So when it gets a chance, it puts a board on the machine, or when it's asked to, it puts a board on the machine, then goes back to doling out the work for the next day. So his stuff was just incredibly advanced. We were blessed, and we really enjoyed the project.
We were. I mean, it taught us a lot. For McGinn Machinery, it was a real learning experience, because there was a hell of an amount of organizing. I mean, there was a very big and expensive project, but it was also, as Mark says, there was 30, 40 containers on the quayside waiting to be drawn down. We had to organize groups of technicians from all different suppliers. And we had to, by the time we were finished, we knew that we could install
anything.
Because we had done what was really a huge.
And their own technicians learned from it. They participated in the whole thing.
So they learned as from the other technicians as they went along, the manufacturers' technicians.
Just on that, I mean, when you're looking back after being so long in business, I mean, the change in technology is huge. But just on that, I mean, you know, when you started off and you were going back and forth to Hanover in Germany or whatever, you must be trying very hard at the moment to even to stay on top of things with the pace of change. I mean, it must take up a lot of your time, does it?
It does, really. Yeah, you continuously have to look at the changes that the manufacturers are making to the machines, so that you're able to convey this information to the customers. And, you know, what isn't quite possible in January might be possible in March. So you just continuously ask, can we do this now? Can we do this now? And we actually had an experience only recently where a customer in the north wanted to buy a machine for facing his fire doors. And I went to a manufacturer and I said, can you do this to this product? And they said, no. And I thought about it. And I went back to them. And I said, I think you can, right? With the way it can be done. Come on over and let's look at the customer's product. And you talk about your machine. When he arrived, he looked at the customer's product. He said, I never expected a product that good. So yes, we can do it. So we sent the samples over. We did the job, and that customer is up and running with that line. And it's worked incredibly well for him. I'd say he's working 3 times faster than his old method and gone from 3-4 workers to 1 worker. So that's what you're looking for.
I'd say that manufacturer is off trying to promote that.
I'm glad we sold another one, but to amaze the guy up in the north, so we're all right.
But this is the kind of thing, though. I mean, nothing beats experience. And when you have a whole schema to draw on for things, you can find solutions to problems that maybe other people wouldn't. But look, I mean, McKean Machinery, where do you feel you are kind of now in comparison to where you started off? I mean, probably maybe it's incomparable, is it? I mean, what kind of difference is there in it?
What I'd say is if you go back to when we were at the height of standard machines, and there were hundreds of machines going out every year, that's all changed. So now you're not so much selling spindle molders and planer thicknessers and four cutters. You're selling CNCs and six cutters and that sort of thing. So yeah, an automated system. So a lot of machines don't even come here. You know, they just go directly to the customer. And then we take it from there. So, you know, that's the change. The change is that you have to get over the hecticness of that machine's going out tomorrow, that machine's going out tomorrow, to has that machine arrived in the customer's place? Who's going to be there to meet it? That sort of thing. So it's logistics, it's intellect of the technicians and the salespeople, and the hecticness of it is kind of gone. And you're now into the organization is much, far fewer machines, but much more complicated for each of those machines.
What I would say is the one thing that has stayed the same, outside of the sales and knowing your product, would be the technicians and the service. I mean, when we started off, we obviously would have started off one technician and built it up from there. But it really is still the core of everything. Somebody buying a machine, they're going to live with that machine for the next 10, 20 years. Well, we have to be there as well for the next 10, 20 years. And that means in 10 years' time, when he picks up the phone, he needs a spare part, he needs a technician, either help over the phone or a technician to fix it. You have to be there because it's, you know, it's no use to him unless it's working.
Yeah.
So I would say at this stage now, I think we've 13 technicians.
Yeah, 12, 13, 14.
Service manager. They have the system is
tablet based. So the everything's electronic. So that when the customer the machine has been serviced, he can have the pictures of the machine before and after the service. He can have the service sheet, what was replaced. And he's then told, you should get this serviced in, say, 12 months' time, whatever. So it's all cloud-based. They can look back on the history of their machine and everything like that. It's really moving ahead. It is. Yeah. And the staff here as well, backing them up on that. There's a new management system in, people in.
Management team, yeah.
The next generation is cutting their teeth at the moment.
And we're getting a little bit older, in case you haven't noticed.
It's all good for the future.
Yes, it is.
Really is.
There's
a lot to be done, though. Always is.
Well, this is. I'm conscious of taking up your time, but I was going to maybe wrap it up on that note of saying, just what's your kind of view on the future of the business or the future of trends or how things are going? I mean, have you any thoughts looking forward?
Very healthy. The industry in Ireland, from a customer point of view, they all have plenty of work. They're driving forward with their aspirations. So as you know, the building industry is very vibrant and is at full capacity and being pushed and pushed to get even more stuff out. So our view of it is we're in a healthy industry. Our customers are healthy. So we should be healthy with them, and we should be the doctors for them sort of as they move on, supplying them the machines, the spare parts, the service, that sort of
thing. But when we talk to the manufacturers, and they would be world leaders, in other words, there's a few world-leading manufacturers of machinery. They see Ireland as buying the most sophisticated machines that they produce. So they're looking to hear from us what our feedback is, because we're not we are one of the leading markets. Even though we might be small, if they knew technology out, they know it's going to come in here really quickly. And that's an indication of the future. Because obviously, you've got Industry 4.0, which is where the machines get connected up and the ERP system is running the whole factory. I mean, I see that the Irish customer is more than up for that. It takes a bit of time. It's something that isn't going to happen overnight, but that's the direction.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, listen, Mark and Owen from McGinn Machinery, thank you so much for talking to me, and maybe we might talk again at some stage and we might have a chat about Industry 4 or something like that in the future.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Yeah, that would be interesting. Yeah.
Okay, guys. Well, thank you very much for joining me. Really, really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me.
Cheers. Thanks.
Perfect.